Hello and welcome to Home to Her, the podcast that's dedicated to reclaiming the lost and stolen wisdom of the sacred feminine. I'm your host, Liz Kelly, and on each episode, we explore her stories and myths, her spiritual principles, and most importantly, what this wisdom has to offer us right now. Thanks for being here. Let's get started. Hey, everybody, and welcome to today's show. How many stories have we lost due to our limited lens of what constitutes history? I think about this a lot. It's one thing to revisit the traditional stories we've been told in history class from different perspectives. For example, this episode is being recorded on Indigenous Peoples Day, or what I once knew as Columbus Day. And there's no doubt that revisiting the story of how this country was discovered, and I'm using air quotes here, from an Indigenous perspective is really important, yet it still assumes that the main story is the founding of America. But what about the stories of how the Indigenous people here lived and loved and honored the sacred? What about who they were without having to envision them solely in relation to white Europeans? And of course, we can ask the same questions of women's stories. There's so little we are told and taught about women's lives, their contributions, their relationships with the land and the sacred. And yet we have always been here. I love this quote from the late Gerda Lerner, author of The Creation of Patriarchy, who wrote, "What is history? We must distinguish between the unrecorded past, all the events of the past as recollected by human beings, and history, with a capital H, the recorded and interpreted past. Like men, women are and always have been actors and agents in history. Since women are half and sometimes more than half of humankind, they always have shared the world and its work equally with men." Amen, or rather, a women. So since I began reading about the history of the sacred feminine several years ago, I have wanted to shout what I've learned from the rooftops to anyone who will listen. This wisdom is our birthright. And this is why I'm kind of geeking out and honored to have today's guest on the show, not only because she has dedicated her life's work to reclaiming these lost stories, but also because I have learned a tremendous amount from her. Max Deschoux is the founder of the Suppressed Histories Archives, an incredible resource for gaining a true global perspective of women's history. In creating the archives, Max has amassed more than 40,000 images from the global cultural record, which she has woven into hundreds of talks on female cultural heritage, providing insights into matrilineal cultures, female iconography and common symbols and patterns found worldwide, medicine women and shamans, and female spheres of power. Many of Max's presentations are now available online for the first time ever, and she also shares a great deal of her wisdom through the Suppressed Histories Archives Facebook page, which is followed by nearly 180,000 people. Max is also the author of Witches and Pagans, Women in European Folk Religion from the Years 700 to 1000, and it's the first in a 16-volume series she's writing called The Secret History of Witches. She is joining us today from her home in the Bay Area of California. Max, welcome to the show. It's an honor to have you here.
Thank you so much, Liz.
Thank you. So I want to start. I know that your research goes a lot farther than just really looking at the history of the sacred feminine. However, because I know that is part of your research, and also because that's really the focus of this show, I usually like to start with most people with really understanding their spiritual background and kind of how they might have come to the sacred feminine. So I'm curious if you grew up in a particularly religious household and what, if anything, you might have learned about the sacred feminine when you were younger.
Well, no, my household was not particularly religious. My father was an agnostic, and my mother belonged to the Methodist Church, as her mother had. But although we were forced to go to church, and that was not my favorite activity, they weren't really into it. You know, we had a lot of remnants of pagan tradition. I mean, for us, the primary religious activities were Christmas tree decoration and Easter baskets, you know, egg hunts, dyeing eggs, those kinds of things, you know, and my mom succeeded in keeping some of that earth-based spirituality going in that way. But for me, really, the from a very early age, it was being out in the land was the wellspring for me. You know, I grew up in sort of a marginal small town atmosphere with, you know, on the prairie, kind of. The prairie was being rapidly covered over by tract housing, but, you know, going out in the empty lots, which we regarded as the woods or the meadows, you know, and that was for me the beginning for all of that. You know, there was no sacred feminine, the other thing I would say, in the Methodist church. There was just a bare cross, you know, and unlike the Catholics, you don't even have the Madonna or any kind of female imagery happening in there.
Yeah, I grew up in a Southern Baptist household, so I can relate to that. There was no even, Mary wasn't really even present at all. Yeah.
And I will say I was jealous because my best friend was Catholic and she had a beautiful little crystal bottle of holy water on her dresser and she had a statue of Mary on her dresser, which was beautiful, you know, and I really wanted one. And my mom is like, we don't do that. and she had a couple of rosaries from her grandmother. So there was like a certain noumena of magic there, you know, along with her little, her plastic horses, which were a thing in the 50s.
Wow. So the earth then, and I really relate to that, that feeling of having a relationship with the land, it sounds like was, I don't want to put words in your mouth. You didn't necessarily say that that was your experience of the sacred, but that's kind of how I was feeling as you were describing it.
That was what I was saying.
Yeah. Okay, good. And what I'm wondering though is, but did you associate that with any kind of feminine sense or at all, or was it just your relationship with the land?
It was the sacredness of nature. Mm-hmm. Where I really connected with goddess imagery was I became infatuated very early. I fell in love with ancient Egypt, you know, and then I had exposure to the statues and the papyrus paintings and the reliefs. And so a lot of goddess symbolism came in through there. And the other way that I connected with goddess mythology was my dad brought home one of these encyclopedia sets, used books. Instead of being alphabetical, it was by subject per volume. And there was one volume that I pored over for endless hours that was on mythology. And so it was mostly Greek and Roman stuff, you know, lacking in many ways. But it was a window into all of this art and all of these traditions. And so I was very interested in that. I mean, I learned a lot just even at that early age from that.
Mm-hmm.
Like for example, the picture of Medusa, you know, various images of Medusa and Perseus slaying Medusa and this image of a male hero triumphantly holding up the head of the snake-headed goddess, you know. It took a lot of years for me to get more of an analysis of what was going on there, but it was certainly visible. It is visible in those stories, you know, they're saturated with sexual politics.
Mm-hmm. And so would you say then that this, you know, this curiosity about mythology, Egyptian mythology and Greek mythology, is that kind of what led to your interest in exploring women's history, or how did you get there?
Well, those studies of the mythology and really of the art, was the big entry point, you know, because you just have a direct energetic connection to the culture through seeing that. That grew, that expanded out as, you know, I went through junior high and high school, and I was always kind of just going to libraries and looking through books. And, you know, I would discover things like the Nine Dragon Scroll from medieval China and just be blown away. It was, you know, I was already in the process of discovery. At that period in time, I was more interested in philosophy. And so it was like reading the male philosophers. And, you know, there's a lot of disconnect as a woman when you look at, you know, Plato or any of them, all the way up to Nietzsche, you know, the invisibility or just the outright demonization or subordination of women in those philosophies. But, you know, I was really interested in atheism in high school because of some of my reading there. And I later realized that this polarity between deism and atheism is, if you're looking from a decolonizing perspective, that's a false polarity. And when you look at indigenous cosmovisions, it's not about whether or not you believe in an entity up in the sky somewhere, but really much more a sacral way of approaching the earth, nature, consciousness, our own energy patterns, the way we interact and relate to everything, you know. And so that is something that, you know, I just kind of left behind both of those categories. And then as I was studying, I began to study women's history. This was really the starting point when I was in college. And that was not really possible to do at that time. There was no women's studies. And it was literally a joke, women's history, the concept of women's history. Mm-hmm. It's like, you can't do that. There's nothing, you know, there's nothing to see here. It was all patriarchy all the way down. So I wanted to really look in a global way and see, where are women? Where are women free? And in the process of doing that, looking in the archaeological record, not the written record, but the actual iconographic record, then I began to see the divine woman, the ancient female icons, the figurines, and other things, statues and other forms of art. And it was very obvious the disattention, if not the absolute silencing and omission of this part of the cultural record, where you see that women are the central focus in the very ancient cultures. You know, when you look at the imagery that people are creating from the Paleolithic grandmothers on forward, the Neolithic, all these technological names we have for different time spans, that the central iconography is of, as I now understand it, the ancestral woman. Mm. You know, and I see the ancestors that are spoken of so much in indigenous discourse and the Black reclamations, cultural reclamations that have been going on for several decades now, very much in a continuum with goddess. You know, that speaking of goddess or the female divine, there are many angles of approach to this, from creatrix, great original mother, all the way through the spirits and powers of nature, the waters, trees of life, all those kinds of things, to divine principles like the goddess Ma'at, or the Dao in China, who is the creating mother of everything that exists under the sky. So there's all of those things. And then ultimately you come to the ancestors, you know, because people are making offerings to them, praying to them. In a matricultural society, it's not that the male ancestors don't matter, but because the women are the procreators, there's the centrality of the ancestral mothers, the grandmothers. And so that's all a continuum. I think that it's, we find ourselves over and over again having to pull back from the polarities that are set upon how we think about all this, you know, by the dominant culture. And we have to kind of try and pull ourselves out of the patrix, you know, and look at things from many different angles in order to get really a more profound vision of how it all fits together.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I had so many threads that sparked while you were talking. I'm going to see if I can hold them all in my head. But I mean, one thing that I thought of as you're speaking is this, you know, when I have thought about languaging the sacred feminine, that's kind of the best that I personally, or that's as close as I can get that resonates with me, because it feels more all encompassing than just simply using the word goddess. Because it does include, in my perspective, it includes the veneration of the female ancestors and all of that you're speaking to, which makes it feel just so much more, it's just larger. It's larger and it's different than trying to label goddess in the same way that you might say God.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of implications to any language we use, as far as where did that word come from? What was its original meaning? What was the meaning that accumulated around it? Mm. So like for me, for example, sacred feminine doesn't resonate for me because I'm a gender nonconforming woman. And, you know, feminine for me is something that was shoved down my throat. It's a very narrowed spectrum.
Yeah, you know, I've heard this from other people too. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so I think that what we really need to do at this moment of time is to work with a plurality of names. I'm not going to say you should call it this and not that. You know, I might object if somebody talks about black magic or something like that in a demonizing way. But, you know, I think that multiplicity of names are necessary for us to really have that broadness of vision. And over time, there's going to be new names and there's going to be settling into patterns that are meaningful for the largest number of people, where we get to the point where we all understand what is meant by those names. I mean, we're in a process of formation and have been since the maybe early 70s of language. How do we talk about this? Because the language is so infused and charged with patriarchal presumptions,
mm-hmm.
you know, and demonizing narratives, and it evokes all kinds of assumptions and stories that are subordinating of women. And so, you know, and we have like a whole range of different cultural traditions also that we have to look at and their approaches. And so there's the whole part where a lot of Native women don't relate to the concept of goddess. And there's many different angles to this, you know, how we talk about the divine in a female face.
Mm-hmm. That's such a good reminder too. That even the need to have a name, a single name, is very patriarchal in and of itself. one label for all.
Yeah, you know, I call this snap to grid. There's like you're dealing with a dominant conceptual framework that is invisible to most people, is unconscious to them. And so you have to kind of bring it, and this is what feminism has been doing, this is what anti-racism has been doing, is to bring to the foreground those presumptions and make them visible so that we can then overturn all of the power relations that they set in place.
Mm-hmm. So a question, I'm gonna see if I can word this right, but so one of the things that comes up for me with that, I look at your body of work and the research that you've done. And it's really truly impressive, and I want to get into that more in a minute. But you know, I'm thinking about as you began doing this research, do you find that the way in which we approach scholarship and research in general it falls within that same patriarchal framework, right? And how does that shape what you do? I'm not sure if I worded that right, but.
Yeah, no, I exactly. And also I would add colonial framework,
mm-hmm.
right? So, or racial framework, you know, because of all these conquests. I mean, if you come through the European literacy tradition, academia, Western civ frameworks, there are all kinds of presumptions built into that, you know, about superiority and inferiority, and the kinds of language that's used really packs in all kinds of values and even behaviors. Who is an authority? So like, for example, when they talk about secondary sources, primary sources, some sources are called primary sources. For example, you know, a Benjamin Franklin writing about the Haudenosaunee, the Six Nations of the Iroquois. He's an important source. I'm not saying he isn't, but he's not really a primary source. That is the oral traditions and the great law of peace and the original cultural record of those six nations themselves, you know? So there's a way that the indigenous perspective gets separated out. Here's an example. I begin in 1969 and I'm prospecting through the libraries looking for where are the women. And there's a way that all the knowledge is organized in the libraries and in other, you know, the departments of universities and all of that, according to categories that separate things out in ways that are not useful if you're trying to rediscover women's history or Lenape history or Apache history, because what they've done is they've got history as the written record, then you've got archaeology over here, you've got anthropology over there, under that you have ethnographic research, which is a lot of it European settlers traveling around in the global south, in the colonized world. And those are valuable testimonials because they are recording sometimes words from the native peoples, but it's all through this view as from above, from the European eye. Mm-hmm. And so there's just a lot of unpacking and interrogation of those sources and the way they put things that we have to go through. Their view of the way that women are described, and you'll have a lot of very negative, derogatory, so-called primary source testimony, say, for example, in North America, about indigenous women. You know, the idea of them being drudges and the idea of them being absolutely dominated by men. This is actually a story that's being told by the settlers about societies, many of which were matrilineal, which had female chieftainships, which had women's councils, often with the power to veto war, a woman with diplomatic power, and yet you've got this picture being painted by the sources. So you have to approach them with a critical eye. And what I've tried to do is to dig out where are the oldest recorded pieces of Native orature from South America, North America, various parts of Africa, Southeast Asia, wherever it may be in the world, Philippines, and see where is the surviving oral testimony? Where can we track it down? Because that is where I really found the juicy things. You know, initially it's like empires upon empires, wars and vistas of conquests and colonies. And women are very thin on the ground in those accounts. You know, occasionally a queen or a concubine, a demonized one usually. But when you get into the creation stories and the oral histories of the Muscogean people, the Cherokee, whoever you're looking at, that's where the really rich memory of female leadership, female creator stories in many cases, like Kokomthena of the Shawnee people, as well as political science information about how those societies were structured. And this is another whole piece besides the mythic, besides the historical and the whole history of conquest, is that if you're looking for matricultural societies, then you begin to see that there are human cultures that are not structured around male dominance and are centered instead around the life support matrix. And that puts women at the center because they're life givers. We don't know who the father is in many cases, but a very stable way of organizing a human society is around the children of the mother. And men belong within that system by blood. They are the brothers. So the pairing that matters in those matricultural societies is sister-brother, instead of the legal constructs of husband and wife that is the patriarchal pattern. And so you have to kind of really, I mean, I'm coming to this analysis after having gone over this multiple different directions, you know, reading all of the source material and, you know, seeing it separated in the libraries, which is where we started with this, that you would go into a certain part of the library, like, for example, the D's in whatever library system that is. The D section is supposed to be like geography and, you know, description of countries and things like that. And in looking for African women's history, I would find whole shelves of volumes about what the natural resources were and the rulership of the colonial regimes and, you know, how to get those resources out of those places. You know, hardly anything about the history that you would find if you went in the European section of the D's. But when you went to the colonized world and especially the global south, it's you're having to plow through all of this record keeping that's really in the interests of resource extraction. So And you would have to go, if you wanted their histories, you would have to go over to the ethnography sections and trying to track down those oral histories, because Western Civ heavily, heavily weights the writings of elite white men or any other men that are of a ruling class that create the written record. And you have to try and somehow come up with the real history of those places as recounted in whatever ways they do that, you know, from the indigenous world. And so that could be the genealogies in the Maori creation chant, or it could be any number of different types of sources.
So hearing you describe this, I'm thinking back to, I read a little bit before we hopped on here, and one of the things that I know is that you chose, or I believe you can confirm this for me, that you chose not to, you know, stay within the kind of traditional academic framework to do your research.
I couldn't survive as me under those conditions. You know, I was just a sophomore. I was a scholarship student at an Ivy League school, and it was extremely patriarchal. And there was just no way that I was going to be able to do the kind of research I wanted to do in that framework, especially this is, again, before women's studies started to actually challenge all these frameworks. And so I just struck out on my own, and I still have my library card. So I was researching, you know, after I dropped out of college.
Yeah, well, you know, as you were talking to, I was thinking about the book Braiding Sweetgrass. Have you read that?
I love that book.
It's such a beautiful book. But I was thinking about her describing her graduate student who wanted to go and learn the traditional ways of the plants. And I forget exactly the story, but this graduate student wanted to interact with these plants in a very native indigenous way. And the challenge of trying to figure out how to present her thesis to this group, and I don't remember if it was all men, I think it might have been, or mostly men, but her challenge of trying to present this information in the academic framework, which, you know, completely favored a particular way of looking at the world, which was, you know, the opposite of what she had just spent the last however many years studying and immersing herself.
Yeah, she had to code switch to learn the botany that she wanted to study. And then she had to go through a process of reintegrating that knowledge with her core tradition. And, you know, she's a really perfect example for some of the dynamics I was just talking about, because anthropologists, a lot of the classical anthropological literature in the late 19th century and in the early, well, actually through most of the 20th century, you have this view as if from above, where they're analyzing these cultures, you know, and they're projecting all kinds of explanations on what they're about. And so there's certain terminologies that arose that to describe something that was clearly distinct from Western Civ concepts and assumptions. And so one of the words that they used was animism. And this was a problem for me, because I like the idea of the word, because anima is spirit in Latin, and they were talking about the idea that spirit or essence is inherent in everything. You know, the consciousness of rocks, the presence of vitality that is in all beings, all living beings, and even the mineral world, you know, that everything in nature has essence to it. And so that's very much part of indigenous worldviews. But I couldn't really use animism because of the way it kind of been used as a club, as a reductive terminology, very dismissive in a lot of the context of its use. Mm-hmm. And so along comes Robin Wall Kimmerer, and she recreates the concept as animacy. And this is part of her whole framework of the verbal and the dynamic or the active nature of native worldview, that it's not a linear world of objects, but instead it's a relationality between all these energetic beings. And so this is something that the women's spirituality movement came to also independently in our attempt to recover the goddess traditions, is that, you know, there was a very important principle that a lot of us were putting out in the 70s, which was that goddess is not only transcendent, she is immanent, meaning immanent with an A, right? That she's present, she's indwelling in the entirety of the cosmos. And so that reclamation of that kind of presence was really important to us. But what Kimmerer did by naming it in that way, she moved it over off of that grid, and she gave it a charge of her own, you know, the idea of in linguistics, a lot of the native languages are modifications on a verbal core. So there's not necessarily the same kinds of names for objects as we have in English. I wrote an article about that called The Meanings of Goddess that really takes apart all these different angles. Like, for example, in the female icons, and I've taken to calling the ancient female figurines by this name because still today in archaeology, they really are, there's a long-standing denial of the sacrality of those figures. And so they refer to them with this very objectifying terminology of fertility idols. And the word idol alone is so charged with the history of all the Abrahamic religions' warfare against the female divine and the icons thereof, you know, and knocking those down, all the destructions that took place and the attempts to stamp out any kind of explicit reverence for the divine with a female face. So that word is very, very charged, and there's centuries and millennia of repression associated with that term. So it's not a neutral term. But then fertility also is not really, it's too narrow. You know, if you're talking about a world of animacy where everything is charged with this vital power, the essence of the universe, then fertility, it's like either, you know, okay, the woman can get pregnant, or, you know, the crops will grow, you know, and those, it's not that those aren't important things, you know, especially, you know, for our survival as humans in the world, but it's the reduction of women only to that sphere, you know, and the reduction of the female divine in ways that are really narrowing and flattening.
Yeah, I've also thought that the language fertility too, it's, well, I don't feel like in our culture we have much of a reverence for life. Yeah. Life giving, life sustaining, life creating, and just even the word fertility, you know, it's not a transactional, is not the right word, but it kind of feels that way to me. Like it's not
instrumental.
Yeah.
Instrumentalizing.
Yeah. Whereas if we had a culture that truly honored life and celebrated life and the nurturance of life and the sustenance of life, then we might be able to view these figurines or, you know, whatever we want to call them, we might be able to see them in a different way.
Yes. And the other part of that is that they're more than fertility. They're also death. They're rebirth. You know, they're used in initiation ceremonies into womanhood in some parts of the world. They are involved sometimes in healing rituals. So there's a whole lot of meanings and ceremonial context for them. Mm-hmm. And for the symbols that are sometimes inscribed on their bodies. There's no question that one primary meaning for them is life force. But to just use fertility, it's just too tied to old school assumptions.
Yeah.
And to the idea of the female divine as somehow not as universal, you know, and this goes back to the fact, I mean, the university system that, you know, modern Western civ academia grew out of the cathedral schools, which were all male priestly organizations. And so there's really a longstanding built-in masculine and authoritarian element to it. And women begin breaking into that. There's a few exceptions, like you have some Italian women who actually did attend university, just a handful. But, you know, in the mid to late 1800s, women begin busting their way in to these colleges and universities. And that process has continued in the 20th century until now. But the problem is they were outsiders. It was made very clear to them that they were outsiders. And you have all these stories about the first women in medical school being forced to sit behind a curtain, you know, and all these separations and even riots by Harvard students because of the presence of a female student in a class. And I don't, recently with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, it came out some of her history where there were 9 women in the Harvard Law School when she was there, I think it was in the 50s. And they were explicitly told, you don't belong here. You're taking the place of a man. You know, so those structures of exclusion of women don't go away easily because there's a whole prestige culture in academia. And so you have to come up under that and you have to somehow win visibility and credibility. And you aren't going to get credibility by talking about goddess traditions or matricultural societies. You know, it's been really, I saw that very early on. It's like, okay, you know, this is impossible. You know, I'm going to just try to do this work and not try to fight all this. You know, I didn't have the economic or the social resources, you know, to do that on my own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I wanted to place this, you know, within the time frame of, well, just some of the other authors that I've read. And so, you know, when you were really diving into this, was this the early 60s? When was it?
No, I
70s.
It was in 1969.
Okay. And so where was Maria Gimbutas in all this? Had her research really been popularized yet, or was she?
No, not at all. Ironic thing is she was at one point at the same school where I was studying, but she was, of course, in a graduate level, and she was busy translating all of these Eastern European archaeological reports for Harvard. And, you know, so I don't know if she was there at the same time as I was or not, but our paths certainly didn't cross. What happened with her is that she began in Bronze Age archaeology, and it was so depressing because it was all just war and hierarchy. And, you know, there was no, I mean, at that point, she wasn't really concentrating on women, but it was pretty clear how marginal women were in those systems. And then she discovered the Neolithic archaeology and the substantive difference that there was and is between those pre-state societies and probably matricultural societies, you know, matrilineal societies based on a lot of the iconography. And this is where she began to really look in. And so her studies of old Europe, she did a lot of work with the ancient female icons and other symbolism in ceremonial models of shrines and the pottery and the paintings on the pottery and the symbols and the possible ceremonial meanings of all of that. Her book, it was published as The Gods and Goddesses of Old Europe. The publisher made her put the males first, even though the feminine presence in the archaeology was predominant. You know, so this is another issue, which is the gatekeepers. And, you know, we were just looking at the gatekeepers in academia, but they're also gatekeepers in the form of publishers and editors. And, you know, you have to leave this part out because the book is too long, or you have to call it this and not that. And we're going to put this picture of Venus on the cover of your book that's really about a much broader vision of goddess. So that gatekeeper is really important because, aside from what it did to the individual work of Gimbutas, it keeps us from seeing, you know, what's chosen for the big color plates and what maybe gets left out or maybe gets a little poor quality black and white photo, you know, inside some archaeological survey or book. And so Gimbutas's book was published, I think, in 76. And at that time, the women's spirituality movement was underway already. She hadn't yet connected with it, but or we with her. But that book made a big splash. A lot of women were buying it and reading it, as they were Merlin Stone, and there was a lot going on in non-literary spheres. I was doing slideshows from 1973 on using the visual record to show women, this is what they haven't told us about. you know, to actually show them and so they could viscerally experience seeing these ancient icons from Nubia or wherever it was, Central America, South America. And there were poets and there were women's dances and there was this whole burgeoning of research and exploration and art, music that was beginning to address all of this. And so Gimbutas begins to end with that by later in the 70s and then on in time. And so that had a lot of impact, of course, because one of the things that did not happen in women's studies as it developed in the universities is a really thoroughgoing exploration of history. There were scholars that were looking at women's history, but the main thrust of women's studies was sociological and literary in its early decades. And so history was partly because it was very hard. It was like, it was at too primordial of a level. You know, there had to be a lot of information gathered, you know, about the cultural record from a putting women at the center. You know, so you have Phyllis Chesler, Women in Madness, and she takes this one topic and she goes back and she looks at the patriarchal narratives in Greek mythology and the symbolic defeat of the female ancestors, the Eumenides or the Erinyes, the Furies, and the way that a goddess, Athena, was used as men's voices in women's mouths to declare her alliance and allegiance to patriarchy. You know, yes. She's always for the male, she declares. Yes. And so Chesler documents that, and you have all these women coming forward with pieces of that. And it was a very heady time. And, you know, I was just at that steer. I mean, I never set out to say, okay, I'm going to start an archives. But I knew from my brief brush with academia, being in academia, that I was going to have to document every claim I made, that it was really crucial to have evidence, you know, and that was really difficult to do initially, especially using the written record. It's easier now because all these books have come out, all these detailed studies, but the art of the indigenous world, of the global South, of all these continents that never make it into the narratives of quote unquote world history, were really rich sources because, you know, you're finding the snake women and you're finding the breast pots and you're finding vulva stones and all kinds of archaeological finds that gave us an idea of who was being revered and how they were being revered and what the ceremonial practices looked like, because we could see on the figurines that women were ceremonially painted up with red ochre or with symbols that are painted on their bodies. And so we get this window into women's ceremony that was thousands and thousands of years ago. So it's very rich to look at the cultural record in all its forms. And so we've got archaeology, we have history, we have to look at history too. There's the indigenous orature, there's comparative religion, many, many different angles of approach for us to basically reconstruct, or if we look at this ripped web of culture, the old woman-centered cultures, which was torn and trampled and burned, and you know, the attempts to destroy it are myriad. But if we try to take the shreds and put them back together and reweave, we're not going to get all the pieces back, but we can get enough. It's like a hologram. You get enough pieces that you can start to envision something of what the entirety might have looked like. And so this is when the book that I published in 2016 is Witches and Pagans, Women in European Folk Culture. And it's dealing with the period between 700 and 1100. So it's the early Middle Ages. And that was the metaphor for me, because so many of the goddess traditions have to do with the cosmic weaver. mm-hmm. and the Fates as spinners and weavers, and they're working with the very fibers of being. And this takes us back to animacy again. But this idea of culture as a weaving is really important. And even if we look in the classical Greco-Roman traditions, that our word text is related to textile. A lot of the concepts that we have for philosophical concepts, ultimately, for the nature of being and the nature of the divine and of time and of human life and experience and culture is weaving, spinning and weaving. So that it's very interesting. That takes us back to the etymologies of where did these names come from and what did they mean originally? And how did that meaning shift as they became rigidified into linear frameworks, into a boilerplate of assumptions that is a class stratified, male dominated colonial society?
Listening to you talk about this, I I guess I have kind of a personal question for you. I'm thinking of just, you know, so I know that you founded Suppressed Histories Archives, 50 years ago now, correct?
Yeah, I'll be 51. It's 51 next month.
Wow, that's amazing. And I'm wondering how you've honestly kept your sanity, you know, doing this.
Is there proof that I have?
You sound pretty sane to me, but no, seriously. Having to work within these structures and yet, you know, we're trying to reclaim these stories and this history that's been suppressed. And yet, you know, I would think to a certain degree, you're still having to, even though you're not working within academic frameworks, you just talked about needing to have the facts and the proof. So you're still needing to deliver this in a way that's going to resonate, I suppose, within this very breakthrough, this very patriarchal world. And that feels like it must be very challenging work at times, or is it not?
No, I think it is, but you know, it's just like, you're right. You have to address those frameworks. You have to address those assumptions and the terminology and all of the things that predetermine the outcome, predetermine their conclusions, because it doesn't include the entire hologram. It only has these parts. And then there are all these silences and omissions. So I use academic research all the time. I work with it. You know, I'm basically prospecting around and looking for those hidden corners and those things that are major that need to be brought forward, you know, the missing pieces of the puzzle. And so I find it of tremendous value, but I constantly have to be critiquing it as I go for all the presumptions that do foredetermine how people look at things, you know, and those are the sexist presumptions, the racist presumptions, the colonial, even those which are forged by a particular religious or philosophical standpoint. And it's interesting because, you know, after it's like you gather, you search and you gather and you begin to collect and sift and sort. And then, you know, you're critiquing it because, well, this piece, you know, they told us this about, well, you know, for example, the pictures that are painted of indigenous women in the Americas and, you know, the very negative, or about the medicine people and how they're tricksters and jugglers and all these terms are used in order to downgrade them because they're coming from, you know, either a Catholic or a Protestant colonial regime that wants to do away with the original cultures in those places. So you have to, you know, turn it all kinds of different ways. So you might find that certain pieces of information, you have to redo them. That's why I say what I do is provisional all the time, because I'm always finding new pieces. And maybe I found one chunk before, and then it turns out that the most important part was left out, and I find it 20 or 30 years later. And then I put that in and try to integrate it. And that can change the picture. Or there might be facts that are missing. Or maybe the facts that come forward, I have to test my hypothesis. You know, it's like my view shifts. And so this is, for example, you know, in the 70s, I'm thinking about there's all these goddesses in the archaeology. And this is the ancient figurines, you know, the clay and bone and stone mm-hmm. figurines. And then the more I learn about the Aboriginal societies, the First Nations, I begin to see that there's other kinds of cultural context that is not divorced from what I'm calling goddess, which is a very broad spectrum indeed, but it's another way of naming and another way of understanding this. And it's a way that really relates especially to how humans interact, you know, to the web of culture that humans create, including the ceremony, you know, the offerings to the ancestors, the desire for rainfall, the desire to conceive a child or to heal, or the search for a particular kind of wisdom, and what ceremonial or ecstatic means are used in order to access that wisdom, you know, and this can involve altered states of consciousness. So you can't really, to my mind, look at this whole cultural record, all these riches, without being able to direct yourself to them in ways other than intellectual or analytical. You have to be able to see them with the eye of dreaming, with the sense that is encoded into them that causes a reaction in your body mind, not only your mind, but your body mind, you know, what it means to see this ancient Southern German house that has plastered walls, and into the walls are sculptured the outlines of female ancestors whose breasts are molded so that they stick out from the wall. And the entire thing is painted with white dotting that shows a numinous field of vitality around the ancestor who is not dead but in another realm. And the fact that the life givers, the mothers, the grandmothers are present in the household with the kindred as they live their lives. You know, so all of this, when you look at that crumbled, it's like the broken breast, you know, over the course of 5,000 years, it fell to the ground and, you know, split away from the overall painting. But, you know, it's those kinds of interactions of our consciousness with these symbols, with the carved wooden doors in Timor, in eastern Indonesia, that have the breasts of the woman ancestor. There's so many, the breast pots that are really a global pattern. And so you can look in Chile, I have a whole poster on the breast pots, the Zulu beer containers, which are carved actually rather than ceramic out of wood, but the image of the ancestral woman. Sometimes the entire body of the ancestral woman is the pot, and the remains of the dead, especially infants who are desired to be reborn, are placed into her body, a symbolic womb, and laid in the ground. So there's all this symbolism around, yes, birth and life, and then also death and rebirth. And we'll see that same kind of iconography in the megalithic statues of Europe in the, say, a period around before 5,000 years ago and moving forward for 1,000 years. And so you've got the ancestral woman with her breasts and necklace as a standing stone, roughly carved. And this signals to us, these are probably matrilineal societies because there's this emphasis on the ancestral woman.
Well, I feel like you spoke to this just now, maybe a little bit, when you were talking about how you interact with these kinds of, you know, the breast pots or whatever it is that you found, these discoveries. But I am curious how, I have to imagine spending, you know, 50 plus years of your life doing this research, that it shapes you, you know, it affects you in some way. And I'm wondering how do you make meaning out of this into your own life? And how has it shaped the way that you experience the world and the sacred?
Yeah. This is a whole journey, you know. In the 70s, I reclaimed my ancestral traditions of witchcraft. And, you know, de-demonizing the witch was really important at that time. It had been so, you know, the millennia of the burning times had really torn things up badly. And so the whole pagan movement and the women's spirituality movement, that reclamation of the wise woman traditions was really important. And as time went on, I was really studying the shamanic traditions, the medicine traditions, whatever name. We don't really have these words anymore in English. You know, this is part of our problem. It was all burned out by fire and iron. But the ecstatic was really important in my journey. I was always a land walker, so that's my initial point of contact. But then, you know, in entheogenic journeys and backpacking in the Sierra Nevada and various other places, walking the land, singing to the land, incantation, ecstatic dance, music, you know, Miriam Makeba and so many other ecstatic musical traditions that allowed me, I had to go through a process of reclaiming my embodiment, because I grew up in the Midwest of the United States under late capitalist patriarchy, and the constraints were different than the more visible ones of, you know, foot binding or the veil or, you know, things people tend to think about symbolically, but they were nonetheless extremely present and very strong. You know, the ways that women's bodies are policed and all the things we had to go through. I mean, the wearing of bras and girdles and setting your hair, which was pretty much de rigueur in the 60s in my time, at least until the Beatles cut came along. So, you know, there are all these ways that defensively and unconsciously I locked down. I locked my body down. You know, the levels of harassment that any young woman is going to get out there in public on the streets is something I had to react to, and I didn't really have the tools. I wasn't really taught or warned about what was out there, you know. But anyway, I had to reclaim my embodiment, and dance, ecstatic dance, was one way I did that. And the land walking and being able especially to be in non-man-made realms. Yeah. This is why I would go to the wildest places I could find, you know, sitting alongside rivers, stretching my bones out on the rocks, you know, chanting, moving, invoking. That's a process of opening. It's like a bud that's been held really tight, and then gradually you begin, the fibers of your being begin to release all this held constraint that patriarchy programs into us, into our body mind. It's like, you know, there's not a division really there between consciousness and the physical form. We get imprinted by patriarchal values and behaviors and imperatives, you know, the way that you're supposed to keep your knees together as a girl and the kinds of shoes they force you to wear and all of that. So for me, that discovery of the ecstatic realm was really important, and to see that mirrored all the ways that exist. And so this is why research into, I have a video that I made called Woman Shaman, the Ancients, the ecstatic, but also all the medicine women traditions. And I include the witch in that. There's different names that different cultures give to this, but again, the academic scholarship on the shamanic is very much was, you know, in the mid-20th century, the biggest authority was Mircea Eliade, and he had a whole thesis that it was an entirely masculine sphere, that women only entered in the period of its degradation and decline. And he goes a long way toward trying to minimize the traditions that he himself was writing about, particularly in the case of the Wu in China, but also the Nordic, the Völler, the seeresses of the Scandinavian societies. It's staring him right in the face, but ideologically he can't accept it. And so he basically just denies the facts that he's sitting there describing to you. You know, it's like, well, this is not really shamanism. This is minor magic, you know? And so there's a very transparent devaluation of women's sacred tradition and women's leadership. In a lot of societies, we have a predominance, even today, in the Machi tradition of the Mapuche in Chile, the Isangoma in South Africa, you have a predominance of women in the sphere of the sacred. They are the leaders. They are the initiators. And it's not to say that males can't participate, but it is really a female sphere of power within patriarchal societies. And this is a whole thing I had to discover because, you know, in looking all at all this and trying to analyze, how did all this happen? How did patriarchy come about? Initially, I think there's a tendency to think that it all happened at one go.
Yes.
And what I began to see over time is just really, you know, I was searching for answers. I didn't necessarily think I had the answers, but let's see what patterns I can discover in the cultural record. And one that I did discover, well, first, of course, the matrilineal, you know, the matriarchal societies did exist. There's evidence of them. In fact, some of them still do exist, although under siege. But then beyond that, in patriarchal societies, does not, although women may be colonized in their sexuality by the forms of marriage, the subordination to husbands, sexual double standards that punish women for their sexual expression, because you can't really have a patrilineage without doing that on some level. Even at the same time that's going on, I would see that other female spheres of power, women did resist. And so in different cultures, you will see those spheres of power manifesting in somewhat different ways. So in West Africa, a patrilineal societies, but you have a very strong sphere of power of the market women. Women are farmers, and they're also the ones who go to market. And so there's an economic power that those women have, and a certain level of self-sufficiency, although patrilineage and marrying into a patrilocal family often meant that the, you know, their access to land came through the husband's family. You know, so there's all these complexities. But the sphere, as I began to recognize this already in the late 70s, that the sphere of power around women's spiritual leadership was a very important area that women, even if it was a patrilineal society, the priestesses, the medicine woman, the diviners, the prophetesses, the oracles, you know, there's just all these different names we could give, the midwives, that represented spheres of power that were defined by women. Women were leaders in this. And you will see some very interesting juxtapositions with this. For example, in Korea, East Asia, you have a very strong survival in very patriarchal societies of the Wu in China, the Mudong in Korea, the Mikogami in Japan. There are these ways that women held on. I mean, they were chosen by spirit. Man-made structures could not prevent entirely the expression of spirit, you know, or the choice of a woman as a visionary, as a healer. And so in Korea, the as I was saying about South Africa and Chile, the predominant pattern is women are mudang or manxin. The mudang word became really stigmatized. There's a whole Confucian overlay that came out of China over the shamanic traditions of Korea. And so people both valued the insight and the power and the wisdom of the mudang, even at the same time that they regarded them as members of a despised class. You know, the families which had mudang were looked down on. They didn't have social prestige. People didn't want to marry into those families. And this is really the reverse of what we may see in egalitarian societies. But in patriarchy, female power is a threat and is branded and demonized in ways that really cause a loss of status. So this is how they coexist. But you have these very patriarchal businessmen going in and paying a mudang to hold a kut ceremony because they have family problems or business problems or health problems. And she is still recognized even by them as the key juncture between them and the realm of spirit. You know, this is where things can be set to rights. So that's a very important area of study.
It made me think a little bit about And I'm actually really looking forward to reading your book. It's been on my list for quite a while, but it makes me think of the relationship to witches as well, before they were burned, and even when they were carrying a stigma, people still wanted their blessings, right? And their help with, actually, I'm thinking of the kids' book I read to my kids all the time, Streganona.
Oh, Streganona, yeah.
Right, where people would still go, for their cures and their guidance and, whatever else they needed, even if it was shunned by the traditional religions and whatnot.
Right. And I did a show last year, which I'm going to be having a stream on demand on my Teachable channel. I'm starting to put up, permanent stream on demand videos. And one of them I'm working on now to just get it formatted for that medium is called Modern Images of the Witch. And so it takes us basically from 1700s to the present. And of course, this is all the aftermath of the mass witch hunts. So the demonization is very well underway. But what's surprising is to see the degree to which the, even though demonized, witch is still connected to the ancient priestess, the prophetesses, diviners, especially the seeress and the oracle, and healers, and also to ecstatic dance and to spirit flight and some of these themes which are, in the larger shamanic traditions of the world. Just for a basket term to describe a varied and yet something that all humans have in common in some way is a birthright. So it was kind of astonishing to me because I knew very well the demonized side when I gathered all the images together to see the degree to which people clung lovingly in some ways or even in allegiance to the wisdom that they saw in these women. They would continue to go to the old wise woman, and they brought their babies to her because they didn't really have any other doctors. They couldn't pay for the university trained doctors. And so this all did survive. And it actually surprised me to see how positive, that there was a lot of positive representations given all that happened.
Mm-hmm. So I know that you have spent, your entire career, amassing this archive and collecting these stories. And I'm not looking for like some kind of, conspiracy theory here, but I am really curious, like how you think it's possible that despite there is so much evidence of these, it's not that these stories don't exist, right? You're finding them, you're collecting them. And they're there, right? And yet so many women continue to know so little of their sacred history or any of their own histories. And how's that possible? How is that possible?
Yeah. And not their fault.
Right. Exactly.
I mean, it is systemically excluded and excised from the cultural record. Now we've remedied that to a certain degree. Since the movements of the 60s or even before that, we had women writing in the 40s and trying to start the field of women's history. Even Matilda Jocelyn Gage was a great seeress and published a book in 1890 called Woman, Church, and State. And she's talking about the priestesses. She's talking about the matriarchate. She's digging all this out, but in the prestigious channels, the academic mainstream, this is all very much non grata. Mm-hmm. It's not welcome. And so it gets edited out by gatekeepers at all these different levels. Now, having said that, there are scholars who are doing this work. There's been an explosion of research since the 70s, and you can actually find really good studies that are not the more general ones, like what Gage was doing or even what I was trying to do in the 70s, but looking really more specifically at this time, at this place. It could be a study about Tuareg women's healing ceremonies and how trees and the wood of trees plays a role within that. Or it could be, just anything. It's just like the number of topics is so vast, but there are researchers who are burrowing into all of the written record and the archaeology and also the process of trying to synthesize all these different streams of information. Because, there was this disciplinary orientation of academia. And it's like this field and that field and that field. And by the 70s, the necessity of interdisciplinary studies became apparent, and nowhere more so than in attempting to recreate a view of women, you know, to restore a cultural memory of women, or of indigenous history, or of African history, you know, because it did get all separated out. And so we can find a lot of times the information that we want is not necessarily in the history books, although increasingly there's an attempt to do that. But also maybe you're going to find more, not only just the history, but the stories, if you're looking at the history of weaving or ceramics, or, you know, women's architecture, you know, women as house builders. There's all these different angles of approach. And it's really in the more detailed studies that you find the juicy stuff. The further away you get up into the overview coffee book table, the story of man type of books, the less you're going to find, at least historically, you know, and that's starting to shift. But I can't even remember your starting point with that. I kind of went off.
No, I was just, you know, I was having a rant moment of wondering how it's possible that we don't.
Oh, yes.
We don't have this information.
And you know, when I gave slideshows in the 70s and 80s and 90s, you know, I was doing visual talks for women, and invariably, you know, because I would always have a discussion period afterwards, somebody would ask, why don't we know any of this? How is it possible that this has been kept from us? And it has been. You know, it may not have been done consciously because they were so arrogant that they just simply didn't think women were important. Or it could have been done out of a threatened reaction, this is really not good stuff and it threatens our religion, or it threatens, you know, some male ego to even acknowledge women as cultural creators. You know, so the gatekeeping happens, but you know, there are so many biases. I mean, here we are on Indigenous Peoples Days. There's so many biases to the way that history is presented to us. You know, even as far as when people talk about antiquity, you know, classically in academia, antiquity referred to the Greeks and Romans, maybe to Southwest Asia and the Egyptians, but it did not encompass the incredible archaeologies of South America, or, you know, the mound temple building civilizations of the Mississippi Basin, or we could just go on listing cultures that completely got left off, Sumatra, Siberia, you know, regions that are just never talked about in any kind of primary school, secondary school, collegial, unless you happen to take a specialized course, but the overviews have not, by and large, addressed the history of most of the planet. And of course, women are more than half of that anyway.
Yeah, that's a topic I can get really infuriated about, really.
We are making progress. We're making progress, you know.
Yeah.
It's and there's a lot of very, sometimes it's hard to catch the implicit bias in the way things are presented, you know, if you accept at face value all of these declarations of the non-importance of women, then, you know, you may not look further. Women get demoralized and discouraged. It's like, who wants to look at history? It's all battles and generals.
Exactly. Know? Yes. Yes. I used to teach yoga classes, and I would do a sacred feminine yoga class, and I would sometimes weave in some of the history before I would start the class. And inevitably there were always, not everybody, you know, there are some women that are like, what is she talking about? I just came here to do yoga. But there were always a few women who, you know, I would show images of some of these Paleolithic figurines and the Neolithic figurines. And sometimes I'd pass them around for people to hold the little replicas. And there were always a few women in the class who just looked like their heads were going to explode. You know, women who are in their 30s and 40s and just like, how did I never hear about this? How is this possible? Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's a visceral reaction.
Yes.
It's not like, you know, when I do my slideshows, it's not that I'm standing up and telling you information. The real impact is because I'm teaching with images.
Yes.
And you actually see the cultural testimony itself carved or painted or woven, molded by the people of their self-image, of what they hold sacred, of the symbols and the whole cultural flavor. You know, it's just saturated with history. A picture is worth a thousand words. It's really true.
Yeah.
And so when you, as a woman, even if you are never going to study history, because a lot of women aren't, it's still transformative to experience these images. And then you realize how much was left out of what you were shown up till now.
Yeah, absolutely.
And not just in education, but in the media, mm-hmm. and movies and advertising and all these other things that go into our collective unconscious that we have to then disentangle.
Yeah. And then that gives you permission to say, I don't have to feel like I have to fit within this framework anymore. Or I don't have to blame myself for not feeling like I fit within this framework. Aha, there's a different way of being. That's been my experience anyway.
Yeah, a portal, a pathway out that very locked in, bound, constrained position that is woman and patriarchy.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I feel like we're kind of touching on this right now, so maybe this will just be a little bit of repetition. But and I'm also conscious of our time here. But I do want to ask you, the significance of reclaiming these stories, particularly at this moment in time, which I don't have to list all this for you or our listeners, but we are. Yeah. What with climate change and it, what certainly seems to me like the death throes of capitalism and the whole political situation in the United States, like what can this do for us?
Yeah. Yeah, it is a pathway shower of other ways to live, because I think people have become so divorced from earth and natural ways, and we need to relearn relationality and gratitude and we really have to learn how to do coalition at this moment in time and join forces and not to engage in some of the persecutory behaviors that the culture has taught us.
Yeah.
The repressive behaviors, but to really learn to work together. And so there's this whole aspect of communal interest, away from the individualist narratives of the great man school of thought.
Mm-hmm.
And how we interact with the divine as embodied, our own bodies, but also as embodied in land and forest and river and the way that we get our food and the buildings that we live in, So, but it's also an important counter narrative, because a lot of people, a lot of women especially, are so demoralized because, well, how can it be different? I mean, one of the core principles that I ran up immediately against in my college experience was the world has always been male dominated. All cultures are male dominated. You really have no hope of things being different because it's always been universally like this.
Yeah.
And that is a lie. So once you know that, once you see that there are other ways of being and doing, you can think about how can we recreate our culture. I mean, this has been going on for this same 50 years, maybe longer, this re-envisioning. You think about artists like Elizabeth Catlett and so many musicians and artists and poets who went back and reclaimed the power of women in the African tradition, for example, and here where I am in unceded and occupied Ohlone country, there's a Native Women's Land Trust that is forming because they're thinking about how do we survive through all of this direness, and keep the old ways going, keep the reverence going. And so they talk about rematriating.
I love that. And when I think about it too, it's not so much as about going backwards, right? We can't go backwards. We're not going to go backwards.
That's right.
But if we know that there are other stories that we haven't been told and there are different histories and that we have lived differently in the past, then we can make different choices in the future.
Yeah.
Which feels really important.
We can be informed and inspired by the past. That knowledge, it can provide guiding principles, but it's not going to be the same. What we're doing now is going to be something, it's going to be a new turn on the spiral.
Oh, I love that.
And it's going to be done cooperatively from people out of different cultural traditions. And we're going to have to learn to do that too, to hold each other, you know, in our recovery of ancestral traditions and our reinventions of new ones, you know, that there is the African community, there's the Native North American community, there are all these, you know, the Pacific Islander communities, the people out of the European ways, and our attempt to do this important reclamation and decolonization that we have to go through. And that's really what my book, Witches and Pagans, is about. It's like, where can we find the authentic cultural testimony? Because it was ripped and torn and burned. And yet I was able to find quite a lot. You know, it's just, you know, we reweave the stories and then we have something we have then. We don't have to appropriate from some other tradition because we have some authentic place to stand.
Yes.
Even though we are not in Europe, we're in North America. So that's part of it too. But we have something of our own that's authentic. And that authenticity is the important part because there's a lot of stuff that's gotten made up, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of the New Age stuff and some of the art and the ideas of what the feminine is in some of that art. Oh, my goddess. You know, very pornified.
Absolutely. And white and yeah. And young and yeah. Yeah.
So that's our task.
I actually can't wait to read this book. And I know we're about out of time. I wanted to give you a chance. I know you have some courses coming up too through Teachable, correct?
Yeah, well, there are some stream-on-demand videos on Teachable right now. I'm going to be adding The Modern Images of the Witch by the end of the month. Have to get that edited. I'm offering live casts. So I've been doing visual live casts for about 10 years now. And you can actually join from your computer and hear and watch the visual talk. And we do an interactive discussion as well. So this month is October is Witch Month. So I'm doing Witches and Pagans Down to the Roots as a live cast. You can find all the link for this on the suppressedhistories.net website, the events tab there. I'm doing a live cast on November 1st for honor of the ancestors around the witch hunts.
Oh, wonderful.
On this coming Wednesday on YouTube, on the Max Dashu YouTube channel, I'm doing a free video premiere of the Persecutory Cultures visual talk. And I felt like this was really important to do, given all that's happening in the United States and the world with the rise of right-wing fascism, anti-Semitism, certainly the racism, you know, that's proliferating. We need to understand, and of course, even just the patterns of witch hunting against women have made their reappearance as well. We need to understand what all these repressions have in common and how they function. We have to be aware of that. So that's going to be Wednesday the 14th at 6 p.m. Pacific. I'm not sure. You'll have to look on the channel, see what your local time for that is. But that's free. And so you can also on just look at the Suppressed Histories website. You'll see a lot of different links to my online course and to the Suppressed Histories Facebook page, which is really where a lot of the work I'm doing now that's open source, open access work. Go to the photos section on the Suppressed Histories page there. And it's a good, easy way to explore through the offerings because I cover, you'll see it's a really wide ground, everything from patriarchal societies to ancient women's spirituality to you name it. There's a lot.
There's so much. Yeah.
And so that's a good way to explore and to get some of the latest because I haven't integrated all of those posts into the Suppressed Histories website, but that's where you will find a lot of the articles. That's where you can access the Woman Shaman DVD and other things that I have.
Yes, and I'll make sure to put links in the show notes to the Facebook page and to your website and all that as well.
Well, thank you.
Well, and thank you, Max, so much for joining us. It's been such an honor to be in conversation with you. I always feel like I learned so much from the Facebook page, and then I've been taking some of your Teachable classes too, and every time I watch one, I get all fired up and want to have, like, you know, multi-hour conversations with people about them. So I'm just really, really grateful for the work that you do.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. And thanks to all of you guys for listening. And hey, as always, if you like this show, you can subscribe, you can give us a 5-star review, you can tell all your friends about it, you can do all three if you'd like. And until next time, I'll talk to you again soon. Home to Her is hosted by me, Liz Kelly. You can visit me online at hometoher.com, where you can find show notes and other episodes. You can read articles about the sacred feminine, and you'll also find a link to join the Home to Her Facebook group for lots more discussion and exploration of her. You can also follow me on Instagram at Home to Her to keep up to date with the latest episodes. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you back here soon.